based on what both of you all had said, and this idea of like this didn't happen by accident. We've been watching this happen over time, right? We've been paying into it. You know, when we think about our tax dollars and where they go, right? And these people that we pay to be our employees, because that's how we have to look at these political bodies, these folks that we elect, and the folks that they appoint. We are their supervisors, but we haven't been acting in that way. So I wanted to just run down three pieces of federal laws that kind of led the way and led the groundwork for all of what's going on right now in terms of militarization that we weren't paying attention to, that we weren't necessarily responding to the way that we should have, and that resulted in what we have today. In 1981, Congress passed the Military Cooperation with Civilian and Law Enforcement Act, which allowed law enforcement and military bodies to collaborate more, to train together, and to share information. That was number one. Number two, in 1990, the National Defense Authorization Act allowed for more equipment sharing between the military and law enforcement for use in counter-drug activities. 1997, another initiative led to the authorization of transfer of surplus military equipment for use in counter-narco activities, counter-terrorism activities, and to enhance officer safety. So this has been creeping for a long time. And in many ways, what, this is gonna sound like I'm coming from the left, but NWA Straight Outta Compton and then telling us what police militarization looked like, and Ferguson showing us what it looked like. So it really goes to like speaking up and speaking out about all of this, about big government, small government, how to push back and make it smaller, because that's what you're talking about. We can push back and make it smaller, and we can handle this. I want to, one, thank all of these amazing panelists. Let's give them a hand. I want to open it up to questions from you all. If you raise your hand, I'll call on you, and then I'll repeat your questions. So go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Fantastic. All right. So my name is Alex. I'm a public policy student at the Heller School of Brandeis University. And I just really want to, first of all, thank all of you. Secondly,
can you use the mic for the interpreter?
I'm going to do that. Thank you very much.
So basically, in class, we're definitely talking about the development of the American political welfare state, and I just wanted to, you know, speak or have the panelists speak on just the role of capitalism, not just in the drug war, but just before that, when farmers and domestic workers were kept out of the New Deal, and before that, when slaves kept the Southern economy alive, and the growing resistance that happened after slavery. I just want to like really speak to how long this policing has happened. Like, we're talking about how this isn't new, how the system is looking exactly how it should be, but I really want to speak to the historical context that we're coming from. This isn't just a war on drugs or poverty. This has been a war on the other for since the development of this country. So I just want to speak to that.
I'm happy to speak to that. I'm sure lots of my co-panelists have a little bit to say on that, but I think that I try to touch upon that a little bit when, you know, during my comments around the ways that certain people are excluded from legitimate economies, right? And from, and I think that that's, again, not an accident, right? That's by design, right? Capitalism is functioning exactly as it has been designed to function. And in that context, certain things are seen as valuable, certain people are seen as valuable, and certain people are not. LGBTQ youth of color who, are engaging in, you know, whatever they have to do to survive, that's not seen as valuable, and the police and the drug war has been put in place specifically to control that, specifically to eliminate that, and I think, capitalism is very central to all of that, right? It's, I think that policing has very often come to control, come to place control and to kind of protect wealth and protect capital, right? And when we talk about public safety, or you know, in New York City, when we talk about quality of life, I've got to give a shout out to Fierce, another LGBTQ youth of color organization in New York City that we work really closely with. They have a campaign on quality of life now called Quality of Life for Who, right? Like, whose quality of life increases when you are policing people for sleeping on the subway, right? Whose quality of life increases when you are policing people for like picking at like an advertisement on the train, right? Like, whose quality of life are you increasing when you do all of these things to make actually poor people's life really hard and to, you know, serve as a source of revenue for a municipality when there's all of these people who are incredibly wealthy who are not contributing to the system in the ways that, you know, that, you know, poor folks are in terms of even just like the chunk, like the proportionality of the income that goes towards paying fines and you know, be, so I think that they're actually quite connected. And I think that, you know, the drug war, as, you know, Amaya really pointed out, has often been served as a tool for law enforcement to protect, you know, the interests of the law.
I'm just gonna follow up on that just because I'm a libertarian, so I have to answer a question about capitalism, right? I would say that, you know, if anything, the drug war and the current state of our criminal justice system, it's the ultimate exertion of state power. State power. It's not, capitalism isn't driving, you know, the drug war. It's the state. It's politicians. It's people who are supposed to represent us. Corporations aren't the ones who are setting policies in regards to drug enforcement. They're not the ones. All right, well, you know. Well, okay, maybe that's not very popular in this room, but I mean, I encourage all of you to examine where these laws are coming from. I mean, who creates laws? It's lawmakers. Who is giving out military equipment to our police officers? It's the state. So.
Cassandra Myers.
First, I have to say I totally disagree. I mean, behind lawmakers, there are huge corporations doing lobbying with a lot of say that in Latin America, this goes back to colonialism, and it's the exploitation of natural resources. And it's indigenous communities who are still being most affected because they still own the lands where these resources are, and the drug war is helping transnational corporations take them out of their communities so they can make a whole lot of money. So the drug war is financed and is backed up by capitalism and by corporations.
We need to really go back from it, from a policing function, is that I'm like a little bit more libertarian in my tendencies, but what we have to do is we have to strip the laws. Like what you're saying over there is exactly how we change communities, because if you go back to the history of law enforcement, you have to understand law enforcement became this autocratic model when we became urbanized, when we stopped taking care of ourselves. Cops don't want to answer the door on loud noise call. People are just afraid to knock on their neighbor's door and say, hey, can we talk about it? You know, would you mind being respectful? We have to strip authority and power. We need politicians to understand that law enforcement is not the regulatory police. We should not be funding law enforcement budgets taking money away from civil asset forfeiture. In California, I was part of a big push on a civil asset forfeiture bill. You know, the cops really pushed back. The criminal justice professional should not be allowed to lobby. It's unethical. Law enforcement at one time in our society was told, this is what I was trained, we don't make the laws. It's not our role to influence lawmakers. It's not our role to get into the legislative policy wonk and do those things. Our job is to enforce the properly constitutionally mandated laws, and that's a big part of the issue. We are not training police officers in the fashion to support our Constitution. And we just, you know, we need to do a combination of different things. You know, we're not going to end police departments. You know, we need to change them. We need to change the dynamics. We need to be collaborators and stakeholders with you and say, how do we reduce law enforcement contact in our communities? And then when we go into the policy wonk is, hey, we have too many laws.
Question over here.
So, you know, it's such a combination, it's a very complex combination, but law enforcement should not be out doing what they're doing.
Well, I want to just point out something. You said that we have to stay away from cops. There's no way that us as individuals, maybe LGBT, youth of color, you cannot stay away from cops. It's hard to stay away from cops, actually. Like, I live on a block where there's, like, a precinct just right next to my door. And it's hard for us being transgender, you know, going into the field of sex working, you know, I'm a former sex worker myself, and to engage in such acts for survival. So it's kind of hard to, like, not be in that predicament where you don't want to be. And so, you know, the government is not always there. They don't see it. They see it as a broader picture of sales. And so you can never, ever trust.
Sex work is the new war on drugs.
Yeah,
we shouldn't have sex crimes laws either.
Go ahead, Rachel.
So I just,
yeah.
You cool? You got to ask what you wanted
to ask.
I
don't need to, yes.
No, it's okay. I was going to ask you a question, but
no,
I
go ahead, ask it.
Especially in the cis precinct out there in the village, how they sexually harass the LGBT community and how they come and shut us down. They tie us on benches, on poles, and they fill us up. They take off our bras in front of men, which is not actually really cool to do, and it's not on your consent. You know what I'm saying? So how can we, as a community, as a nation, how can we support that and try to, like, find ways that even though this drug is our survival, in a way, we do have to take drugs when we sex work. You know, we do have to have these drugs to sell. This is our money we're making. This is something that we'll have, like, a little bit of chump change in our pockets. At least I know that I'm going to eat at the end of the day. You understand? Why is that becoming a problem? It's becoming an issue to all our Latinas, or, you know, our trans folks, our black citizens, and it's crazy. So how can we really change that without changing the community?
Well, first, I just want to really appreciate your comments. I think it raises all kind of great issues and draws off of a lot of what's been said on the panel. For the sake of clarity, I wasn't suggesting that it's easy to stay away from the cops. I live in the world. I know that it is not easy to stay away from the cops, right? And, you know, I used to live in New York, so I know what it is to try to stay away from those cops. That being said, I don't think it's your individual responsibility to stay away from the cops. I think it is our collective responsibility to reduce the contact that cops get to have with anybody. Right? Yeah. And so, I actually don't think it is possible to address the issues that you're raising without fundamentally changing the criminal justice system.
Correct.
And, you know, frankly, you know, I'm not necessarily for small government, Shakira. I'm not suggesting that there's not a role for the state. I actually think there is a role for a state. You know, and I don't necessarily think that it's the craziest dream in the entire world to start taking steps now to shrink the prison industrial complex to elimination. I want cops to be out of business. I think that's a fine thing. Right? Is that our current reality? No. But do I think all of us can take some steps right now today to move in that direction? Absolutely.